Hello and welcome back to another podcast episode in Business Review Greece. I'm Harry and I have with me Dimitris and Alex. And today we have another special guest. It's the first guest that is not a Greek native speaker, a person that makes so different things and something so different, so unique, and something that have a lot of impact. So we have here, directly for Monaco, Mr. Troy Armour. Welcome. And thank you, Harry.
Great to be here. So just to clarify, I'm originally Irish. So moved to Monaco in the last year, but will not give up the Irish nationality just yet. But it's great to be here.
Welcome. We're really happy to have you here. As Harry said, you're the first person that we will do an English podcast. So it's an experience for us also. You have done many things. You've built many businesses. I wanted to ask you, you're doing fashion shows in the biggest, like, major cities, Abu Dhabi, Milano, many cities, USA also. Can you tell us a little bit about the brand Jungle Tour and a little bit of the story, how you started doing this?
Okay, so Jungle Tour is an integrated entertainment, media, and sports business. The concept is that I wanted to create a sport for kids that were creative. So to kind of explain how that is, as a kid myself, I was a very creative person. I was terrible at sports. So I was that kid that would not have got picked for any football team. But at the same time, football brought such social capital. So the kids that played sports were part of tribes, their team. They were recognized for their skills. They were coached. They got to travel for the school. Kids like me who were much more creative, we kind of congregated in the corners. And I say it now, like in every classroom in the world, there's this creative energy sitting dormant. So I wanted to give that creative energy a platform that it didn't have in a sport. And I will be honest, for the first 10 years of this, it's 13 years old now, even my team struggled when I said the word sport, right? Because so the challenge was that teenagers would create fashion from trash and then they would compete on stages. The idea was they would have 1 minute. They had to choose music themselves, and then they had to choreograph a routine, and we would have judges to score the dress, the materials that they used, this kind of idea. Going back to 2010 when it started, just to give some background to like the business side of it. So Jungle Tour does two things. The idea is that it finds the diamond inside young people and polishes it so it shines. And you see these young people grow. It's a huge impact. And I'll tell you some of the stories later of some of the kids that I have met over the last 13 years. That's one. And two is that it delivers solutions to partner companies that we have to problems that didn't exist 20 years ago. The word sustainability, you didn't hear 20 years ago. Inclusivity, circularity, you know, this young entrepreneurship, circular entrepreneurship, as I call it. So 2010, I at this point owned three companies. I remember the idea and speaking with my wife, and she's like, no. It's a crazy idea. I don't see you anyway. Plus, we're not spending money on this. So I, of course, undeterred, the right entrepreneur, the word means to try, is like, okay, let me try and start a business with €1,000. That was what I said to her. I will build a $1 million business from €1,000. She said, that's the maximum. I will allow you to spend €1,000 and that's it. And so 2010 started this journey of and I needed the challenge. I thought the challenge was really important for me. But one of the things I would say, if you start a business tomorrow with no money, you need to innovate. That's the only way you can do it, because you have to solve problems. And I'll give you an example of some of the problems. Like, so as we grew the big Live Nation venues, I don't know if there's one in Athens or not, but the big venues where Taylor Swift or Cope, whatever those big venues, the indoor ones, 20,000 people, you go into those with a promoter. That's the way it works. So the promoter agrees a price with you, that's what they pay you. They go in the venue, they set the tickets, and then they do all the advertising for the tickets and they sell the tickets. And so I said, I'm not going to do that. And I remember the guy saying, it's impossible. Like, the promoter has all the radio stations and that's the way they do it. So I found this guy in Elands in India. I said, I have a budget of $400. I need to create an app that is like a viral voting app. So what we did was, when the kids entered, we put them all in this app. And then, so like, if Harry had to vote, Harry would go and vote for you, right? He had 5 days to vote. The way it worked was, every day he voted, we would double the vote, and on Friday he would have four extra votes to give to you to encourage him to do it every day. But every day that he voted, then he would get a pop-up to say, "And now you voted, now come see the show." So we used to sell all the tickets without marketing or spending any euros on marketing. And I remember when we sold out the arena, the guy was like, "This is not possible. I don't understand it's possible." And I said, "It's always not possible until somebody does it." But Junketure now has grown into, we're in 35 countries across the world. We have these six shows in these six different cities. They become hubs. So for example, in Paris, we have kids from Madrid, Amsterdam, they all congregate to Paris. This year, for the first time ever, we had our first world final. So I'm ultimately creating the Olympics of creativity. So I want a World Cup. So last year it was in Abu Dhabi, and in 4 weeks, the next one is going to be in Monaco.
Amazing. So what was like your first event? What was the attendance? How you managed to do it with such
a... You're going to embarrass me now.
I need to know how you managed to do an event like this. That sounds like crazy to someone. Like, why should I come to and watch something like this? I mean, in first sight, it seems crazy. Your budget was so low, and how you managed to do it in Monaco with a completely different level that you will have now.
So the very first show, so that I spent 1,000 euros, and the way I did that was there was 967 schools in Ireland. A stamp was 1 euro. I wrote 967 letters, so I had to hook them with whatever I put in the letter to the 967 schools. 194 wrote back and said, "We want to be part of this." And I remember, like, me and my wife were sitting on the couch, and then she said, "What happens now?" And I said, "Now we've got a problem, because now we're going to have to put shows, because we're going to have these 194 kids. What are we going to do with them?" So I remember going to see this production guy. He was local to me. I didn't know him. In fact, I have to say this. I didn't know anything about shows. I run an IT company. I didn't know anything about shows. So I'm making this up as I go, right? Totally. I couldn't tell you stage left or stage right. I don't know a thing. So I go to meet this guy, and I said to him, "Look, I'm going to have these shows." He immediately, after a few minutes, says, "Okay, four shows and a final, it's about 30 or 40,000 you're going to need." And I said, "I don't have that. I have maybe seven." And at this minute, I'm doing math in my head going, how many tickets will I sell? Maybe 1,200 per show, that will have a pay. And he said, no, you didn't listen. You need 30 or 40,000. And I said, "No, maybe I can get eight." He's like, "No, 30 or 40,000. I'm like, "Maybe I can get nine." And at nine, I don't know how I did it, but he turned around to me and he says, "It sounds so crazy, but it also sounds fun. I will do it for nine. The deal is that you pay me that night. Before I leave, you pay the guys the 1,800. And so we set off around Ireland to do these shows. And the same, we held them originally in hotels on a Sunday night, because hotels on a Sunday night were empty. So we said to the guy, "You give us the room for free. We will bring 200 or 300 people here. They'll buy Coca-Cola and wines and so on." So the hotels were fine. What I didn't expect was the reaction to the show. I didn't know what it was going to be like, because it was off the charts. And what happened was the shows were sold out, because these kids that were involved were kids that never really got to be in shows before or on the football pitch or whatever. And so then they came with granny and granda and uncles and friends. And at that time, like, me and my wife used to sell the tickets at the door. We kept every cost as low as possible. So that first year, we did the five shows. We did some PR. I remember us doing PR. I called a guy who still does my PR today. And from that PR, I got a phone call from a company who said, "I love what you do. I want to be the sponsor." And I remember the first sponsor we got was a bank for 25,000 euros. And 3 years later, that deal was 1.7 million. It just became so fast, organic growth. We put all the money back in. Schools were doing one dress this year. Next year, they were doing 70. They saw what the empowerment it did with kids. They saw these kids get recognized. And a lot of kids who drop out of school drop out because they don't like to be put in a box. Like, you're entrepreneurial people, right? I always say this, the thing that entrepreneurs love the most is the thing that you're not allowed to do in school. Cheat. Entrepreneurs, we cheat. You're told you can't do it. Do we listen to that? No, we don't. We have to find a way around it, right? But you try and find a way around the exam in school, you're out, right? So, like, I mean, how can people who are creative, because that's what creative people do, we're entrepreneurial. So school is very difficult to put you in timetables. I'm a creative person. I don't write anything down, right? I have all my diary for the next 8-12 weeks in my head. When I find people who give me lists, I'm allergic to that. I'm a creative. That's one of my positive things. It's also a negative, because for a team, it's very hard to work with someone who doesn't write anything down. I'm with Tassos Panidas. He's one of my board members. I'm with him for the last couple of days in Greece. And he's like, are you taking notes? I'm like, no, I don't take any notes. It's all here. Trust me. He's like, no. You have to take notes. Everybody has to take notes. That's what they do. So it's just, that's just one of my things. But I think the journey itself, setting out at the start, I never thought where I'd end up. But this year, to think I'm in Monaco, over that period of time now, we have some global sponsors and they've helped. You ask the question about, you know, a show in Monaco. I spent a lot of time going to Grand Prix down there, learning the business of sport, watching what happens, how they monetize the things. And Monaco in the Grand Prix circuit was special. It is the Grand Prix that people want to be at. The glitz, the glamour, the buzz, the atmosphere.
For some people, it's a once-in-a-lifetime event.
It's a once-in-a-lifetime thing. Yeah. In fact, some of the teachers whose kids are in the final have written me mail saying, I've watched Formula One for years. I never thought I would go to Monaco. Now I'm going to Monaco, you know, with the kids or whatever. And I was able to say to them, I don't know any Formula One fans between you or not, but across the road from the theater, like Toto Wolff lives across the road. Right? His apartment is right across the road. So I said to the guy, Toto Wolff lives across the road. I will show you where it is if you want to go bing the bell to say, can I come for tea? Go for it. I don't know if he'll answer, but you can go for it. But that's the kind of world it is. Monaco's an international village. There's 30,000 people there. A lot of them. And for an entrepreneur, it's an entrepreneur's dream, because there are so many who are at different stages of that. There's the guys who have created global companies, the CEO of Expedia, CEO of EasyJet. These guys live there. They've created the companies. They've done that. They've lived their lives. And you see them in the street. So if you can stop and say, hello, how are you? Like, I was walking in the street recently and Michael Flatley, who's an Irish entertainment guy, he's worth $500 million. And I just said, Michael, how are you? And I had 15 minutes talking with him in the street about what I was doing, where I'm going. That it's a great place to soak that up. And at the same time, then you have the generation like me that are before that, that are now still in the throes of it. And it's a place then that sees opportunity and goes after it and appreciates. The show is in 4 weeks. The partners that we have, Deloitte, Microsoft, DHL, Etihad, Eurospar, they have now put, you know, a different structure on what Junketure is doing. I have an ambition to grow that sponsorship revenue. But the next thing then for me to focus on is media rights, because sport, big money comes in media rights. That's the end goal.
So right now the revenues are from sponsorships and ticket sales. And you're going to open the line of media covership, like to sell it to a TV channel to broadcast.
Yeah. So at the moment I have a small media partnership in Ireland. I'm using that to learn, because it's crucial that I get the product right too. So that in a way is my MVP of that. And I can fine tune without the whole international world looking in and saying, there's a mistake. Because one of the things about Junketure is that it's very disruptive. Like what I told you about no promoter, right? It's disruptive. So we did everything the opposite of what we were told to do. So it's the same. And I've been in this conversation, like I went to meet these big TV producers. And they told me, the first thing they said, okay, is because they were comparing it to X Factor or one of these things. They said, 3 hours, nobody's going to watch it. 3 hours on TV is boring. Because that woman or that person was seeing that through the lens of, here would be, Greek's Got Talent. Is that a show here? Mm-hmm. So Greek's Got Talent, right? So that through a lens of that type of show. And I said, but it's not that. That type of show is just popcorn TV where you can watch it this week. It doesn't matter if you don't see it for 2 more weeks. You can watch it. It's nothing on TV. You tune in. You are not connected to it. And it doesn't have a community. And then so what I said to her was, okay, isn't it lucky that you weren't the woman who decided whether golf was going to be on TV or not? She's like, what are you talking about? And I said, okay, I'm coming to pitch golf now. So 36 hours of men with sticks chasing a ball around a field. 36 hours of it. Does it sound sexy? Do you think people are going to watch it? You're going to say no, but it has a huge TV following, right? Because it's packaged a different way. It's packaged a way, and then you have a community. And even people who don't play golf, because I don't play golf, But I tune in if, like, Ireland has a few famous, Rory McIlroy, if he's doing well in a big US tournament, I will put on the last day and watch little bits of it. Or the Ryder Cup is always one that brings interest. But ultimately, it's the community around it who are interested in the sport will tune in every week, religious. And they will watch 36 hours of men with sticks chasing a ball around the field.
That's very true. In Greece, after we have like one of the world's best tennis players, Stefanos Tsitsipas, and the whole nation, like, it's not that we watch tennis ever. Like, in Greece, we watch football and basketball. But when Tsitsipas plays, you can hear everywhere that, oh, he did that, or
the you're nation connected comes to together. Him, yeah. For him. So it's the same. But that's what sport does. So for me, Junkature is the same as building a community, the community who are watch the media rights. So for me right now, I'm in learning mode. The people who I meet that are 30 years in that industry and are going to see it with that lens, of course, anything that's disruptive, the first thing they're going to go, that's not going to work. Because that's what everybody says when something new, disruptive comes along, it's not going to work. And so the entrepreneur has to cheat that, has to find a way around. And then when it hits, go, everybody stands back and goes, wasn't that a simple idea? And that ultimately is what I'm trying to do. Because if I go back to 2010 when it started, the first call I made was to a TV producer. I asked a friend who knew another friend who knew her mobile number. So there's a fashion show in Ireland, and I know that I phoned her 14 times in the one day, because when she finally answered that night, she said, I have 13 missed calls from you. Please tell me this is urgent, right? And I said, no, but I really wanted to speak to you. And I wasn't sure if it was ringing or not ringing. So anyway, I explained the concept. I said, kids are going to design fashion from trash. They're going to be on the catwalk. We're going to have people come. You know, I'd love to get the kids on TV or whatever. And so she said, this is a silly idea. You're cuckoo. You don't put trash on a catwalk. You've got the whole wrong end of it. It's high fashion has to go on a catwalk and all. She said, my advice is don't do it. And I remember, like, my wife was there. So you talk to her. What did she say? And she said, don't do it. So what are you going to do? And I was like, I'm going to do it. Right. And it's the same whenever we got the first, like, this is the time we had no money, right? The first sponsor that we got, even though it was 25,000, we had a small PR guy, but we had no PR company. So they had a huge one, right? So they used to make me every week go on a call. It was back then, it was no Teams. You had to do the call in conference call. So on this conference call, and we're talking about different PR ideas. And so I was in the thing of, I want to do guerrilla marketing. I don't have money, so I want to do guerrilla marketing. So you're talking to people who are PR agents for a bank. Boring. Everything is so structured and all, and it's whatever. That's what they have to do. And here I am. I'm this mad guy, mad scientist, and I'm going, okay, I've got this idea. So the idea was, at the time, through my IT company, I used to give some donations to a charity, and I used to get two tickets to the Royal Film Premiere of whatever movie was every year. So I've been to, like, the Bond movie premieres in London. It's an incredible experience. So this particular year I had two tickets. The event was in 4 days. And on the call I said, you know what I'm going to do? I'm not going to go. I'm going to get two of the kids in their dresses to go instead of me. And the woman's like, this is a silly idea. Like, what's that going to do? And I was like, no, we can get some PR from it, whatever, right? So just the fact that she said, the thing that she said to me was, you stick to computers, because that's the way they saw me, and let me do the PR. So I remember I hung up again. My wife said, what did she say? She said, no, it's a stupid idea. What are you going to do? I said, look, you know what I'm going to do, right? So this is what I orchestrated, right? When you go to the film premieres, those premieres, the red carpet is like, it's not divided, but it's a natural thing, because security stands in the middle at the start, and he's telling you, you're on one side or the other. So the celebrities are all on the left-hand side, and they're facing the crowd, and they're signing autographs, doing interviews with different TV channels and so on. And then the other people, the normal folk who did the editing or who did charity work and got a ticket, they go up the right-hand side. And when they go up the right-hand side, they go in the door of the cinema. The other guys, when they come to the door of the cinema, they don't stop. They go into a big square where they got their photos taken for the newspapers. So I get these two young girls, they're 16 years old, and I tell them, we've been invited to go to the Royal Film Premiere in London. Paparazzi are going to do a whole feature on you. All you have to do is get the dress on. When you go up the red carpet, don't go in the door. just go into the square where they take the pictures. And because I said we weren't invited, right? But they had to believe in their heads that they were invited. So the two girls go. I couldn't go because you can't get past security. So online, I'm with a laptop outside. I find a webcam in Leicester Square so I can see the whole thing like live. And so then I said to them, I'll tell you when to go so that you don't bump in. So when the square was empty, I said, okay, go. So the two girls walk up, they walk past the door, they go straight into the square. And of course the paparazzi think it's part of the PR of the movie. So that they just start taking pictures. And the two girls, they get all, I don't know if we can show the picture to the audience at home, but the next day, these two girls were on the front page of all the papers. I had to write an apology to the PR company of the premiere because Kate Blanchett was the star of the movie and she was only on page 3, right? And so the PR company, the woman told me after, she says, I got like dead. The movie company was like, we didn't get any PR. Like this, who are these people in the front page? Where did they come from? But again, we did it again a couple of years later. It was a different movie. It was the Nelson Mandela Walk to Freedom movie when it came out. The premiere was in London. And it was funny this actually because it was that night of that movie premiere was the night he died. So we went to the movie premiere and I'll tell you the story about that at the start. But at the movie premiere, his kids were there. He was ill. His kids were there. It was all a celebration of his life. In the middle of the movie, this crying started. We didn't know. Nobody knew what was. Just felt that somebody was crying. But when the movie ended, somebody got up and says, I just wanted to keep your seats a second. We need to have a minute's silence because Nelson Mandela just passed away 1 hour ago in the middle of the movie. I tell you, it was like, it was an experience to be there in that moment. But what happened before it was, I remember I got the tickets. I had more tickets this time, so I went myself. I searched the PR company that was doing the PR. I knew the boss was Murray. So I told all the kids, if anybody stops you, just say, we have permission from Murray. So we're all in the red carpet, right? You two, Bon, all these famous people, because you two did the song, all these famous people were there. Idris Elba was the guy that was Nelson Mandela. And so the Junkature kids are up the front, they're getting pictures, and I see security messing with them, like, move on, move on. And I'm like, no, get in the picture. So eventually this woman comes to them and says, like, what's happening here? Like, the security's trying to move you. And they said, no, we're fine. We have permission from Marie. So she said, okay, who are you here with? And they said, that's the boss guy there. So this woman comes to me and she said, so you're with these girls and, like, the security's trying to move them on. And I said, no, it's okay. Like, I have permission from Marie. And then she said, I'm Marie. And then I went, oh, Marie, it's great to meet you again. Don't you remember? I know that I never spoke to you before. So she at least saw the funny side. And I said, okay, we'll move. But the same, we did it then at Cannes Film Festival. The same, like, we landed in Cannes. We landed in Nice. Everybody stayed in Nice because it was Cannes Film Festival. It was crazy money. We came into Cannes. We got changed. And then they just hit up to the front. And the paparazzi just went light bulbs everywhere. And the same, I have taken the idea of I'll do it and ask for forgiveness later. But that has helped explode what I do so much, that attitude. I don't know, people like it. I mean, nobody's ever said to me, you shouldn't do it. Like, it has been great fun, I have to say. It's so much more fun when you see the next day that you are in the newspaper or whatever, and you paid nothing.
I think you're like the Irish Richard Branson.
I don't know if I'm the Irish Richard Branson or not. But the thing is this, is I do like the crazy ideas. And that's a thing, like, I would say in my team, that one of my culture values is don't bite me, beat me. So, you know, if somebody comes with the most crazy idea, I hate when somebody says, no, that'll not work. It's like, no, come with something better. Because if not, we're going to do that. I don't care what it is. And I'll tell you, you know, when I managed a band for a while, right? We're talking about it earlier before the show. The guy sang in the Irish language. And so I was like, okay, what? And I did some crazy things, but... And it just goes to show you sometimes how doors can open. I am a great person for guessing email addresses. I've guessed email addresses for all kinds of people across the world, but this particular one was Barack Obama. He was president at the time in America. And I wrote this email and said, you know what? I have these guys that sing in Irish language. You have a party every St. Patrick's Day. I would love the guys to come and play for you. So I didn't get a reply, right? So that was February, March passed, St. Patrick's Day passed. And then one Sunday in June, I'm lying on the couch watching the football. My wife is sitting beside me and my phone rings. And my wife immediately goes, who's calling you on a Sunday? Like, don't they know that's your day off, right? And I was like, it's okay. And it says unknown number and I answer the phone and this one says, hi, can you hold? Fine. And the next thing then this other person comes on, hi, this is Jen from the White House. President's coming to Ireland and he wants the guys to come play for him. Can you organize it? Is this for real? And again, like we managed then to drive so much marketing value off the back of that, you know, and that's what I say to people. And the very harnessing thing, if I go back to whenever I went to MIT, this thing of the list of 25 people that could affect your brand in an exponential way is the most crazy names that you can put on there. And then someday you go, you know, how can I get to that person? And what would I say to them if I did? And it's funny, like I've put in email addresses of people. And so what I do is okay, know that you know the domain name, right? I'm Troy Armour. So if you put in Troy.armour, Troy_armour, T Armour, Armour T, just keep putting them all in, like every kind of possible combination, and make sure you have delivery receipt and read receipt turned on. The next thing you'll get the undelivered, 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 and you'll get it delivered. And then you just have to wait to see if they read it. And if they read it on an iPhone, you'll instantly get a read receipt and you go, well, at least they've read it now. And then you just never know what comes. But that goes back to that entrepreneurial word again, try. If you try, you just do not know what'll come back.
Does your past success from your other businesses help you growing the new brand?
Yeah. Like we didn't talk about that at all, but like I left school when I was 17, didn't really fit in school at all, did an accountancy apprenticeship instead for 3.5 years. And then I set up an IT company. And if I look at, that was 1996. If I look at between 1996 and 2018, I would have described myself as a hustler. I don't come from a business background. I come from a small village of 4,000 people. I didn't know anything about business. I didn't call myself an entrepreneur. I didn't even like the word. I was allergic to it in many ways. And I've come to realize too now why I've met so many people that are allergic to the word. And the way I describe that to people is, if tomorrow you went to college to be a lawyer, you get a degree and you go do the law exams and so on, and at the end of that, somebody puts a big stamp on a certificate to say, you are a lawyer. You are now validated by a third party. Become an entrepreneur, you have to stamp your own certificate. You have to validate yourself. And whatever it is about humans, self-validation is always seen as egotistical, or who do they think they are? What does he know about entrepreneurship? Calling himself. So most entrepreneurs shy away when the word comes up. So, and I would have been the same. I was like, you know what? I'm a hustler. I had no strategy. It was month to month. It was very much month to month. So 1996, 2018, four companies, all hustles. And that's months of going, oh, am I going to pay payroll at the end of this month? Phew, got over that one. How's it the 10th of the month already? 21 days left, right? But somehow they all seem to grow, right, in some way. But in 2018, that was a thing that changed my life in a lot of ways was I am a member of that. In 2015, I found the organization, Entrepreneurs Organization. And one of the first things that I got from that finding was there were others like me. Because before I didn't know there were others like me. And I know now there's a different ecosystem. Podcasts like yours bring awareness. Schools are more involved in entrepreneurship and so on. But at that time, I thought I was weird. My family thought I was strange. They didn't know what, I wasn't in a job. I was doing my own thing. But in 2018, I applied to do this master's at MIT that EO run. It's called EMP. And that then kind of brought the ideas of strategy, vision, values in a business, because I had values in my business before that, but I copied them from somebody else's. I didn't know what the values were. And even one of the first weeks in MIT was around company values. And I remember going, oh, I'll be interested to hear this. And like, I've got really cool ones because I copied them from Zappos. It was a shoe brand in the US. And then I'm listening going, okay, this explains why I hire the wrong people. Because company culture is really who you are yourself. So it's who are you? And I remember whenever I sat down and to go, who am I? And I was like, well, first thing for me is family first. So the people that are around me come first. And so then I realized that, so if one of my team has a sick child, are they really focused on work? No. I'll just give them the time off. So that's the rule in our company now. If you even feel stressed, you have a problem at home, your child is not well, it's an automatic, you don't have to go fill a form or anything, but you have to text me. You have to text me to say, my son is not well at school, I need 2 hours to go pick him up. And I will say, okay. Or I'm not feeling well today, I need 2 or 3 days, just my head cleared. That's okay. It has a massive amount of respect. People say to me, no, they'll take weeks off, they'll go on holidays. It is a game changer. And it's just this trust two-way street going the same. I need them some night to work late. They've already had time off. They say yes. It's crazy how it works. But then it was like, and I started to look at what are the things. I like excellence. I like humility. So I start to put these things down. And then it was I start to realize going, okay, so if I hire people around these values, of course they're going to align with me. Because that's me. That's me described. That's, you know, the MIT thing did a lot to change me, show me the purpose of what I wanted to do. The story around that really was the first night we were there, the guy brings out a box of Kleenex and he said, we're going to need this tonight. And you've entrepreneur, you had a 3 million minimum revenue to be in this. So you guys there, global entrepreneurs looking at each other going, I'm not going to cry. Because you don't understand why you're going to cry. But eventually when they work their way around to you and they come to me and he said, so you have these 4 companies, but on your application form, you said you've you've an affinity with this junketure. And he just started saying why. And I said, I like working with creativity and colors and kids and energy. And he just kept saying, but why? And at the end of 8 or 9 times of why, I just started to cry. I didn't realize what he was doing, but what he was doing was he was breaking down my walls. He was getting rid of all the stuff that was hiding what really was me. And I remember the words coming out of my mouth that I did not expect to come because I couldn't answer the question really. But the words coming out of my mouth was, every one of those kids is me. And in that moment I realized, and he said it to me, that's why you're going to go through that wall to make this happen. And it's moments like that that have helped me as an entrepreneur now to realize I can be a leader. I can change the world. You can't do it all at once, but if you have the right vision, you can go there.
I think I read somewhere that it's after the 7th why that you find the real answer to something.
Okay.
So maybe that was the main
point. And I say 8 or 9, but in truth, I don't remember. Mm. It felt like it was half an hour. And your peers are looking at you, just feel the eyes staring in. And I'm going, and I mean, the expletives coming out of your mouth. You're like, F them, I haven't told you.
It's pressure.
Combined. You know, it's just... It's funny, and I never thought that's where it was going to go. And before that, you know, my sister who works in the IT business with me would have said to me many times, why do you put so much work in this junketure thing? I was like, I don't know why. I don't know. I can't answer it. But the other thing that happened that night then was I realized that I needed to tell people who I was as a kid because I never did. That was the walls that I had. So as a kid, I was the geeky teenager. And I used to think if I tell people that, because when I was a kid, nobody wanted to hang out with me. So if I tell my team that, they're going to go, we're not working for that guy. He's the creepy, weirdo teenager. Get out of here quick. Instead, it had the opposite effect. And I remember doing a radio interview in Ireland the first time I went on radio to talk about that. And I had 70 calls. I had one guy calling me, much older than me, in tears saying, I wish I had your courage to go on and say that. Because he said, I was the same, but I still couldn't tell anybody. In a lot of ways, entrepreneurial people were those ones that are different. And one of the things that I love about Junketure now is, and I use this line all the time, it's how I live my life, is that no one ever changed the world by being the same as anyone else. And like ultimately the people who are different and who dare to cheat, who dare to dream, are the ones who create the future. That's what happens. Because when other people look at that door and say, well, that door's fine. That door, if they look at that and say it's fine, that door will be the same for the next 100 years. But an entrepreneur will look at that and go, let's an air around the outside of it. And see, he'll see the problems it's got. Or she will see the problems. I'm going to fix that.
Which was your vision when you were a child? Did you know that you want to be an entrepreneur or it's something different?
My mother jokes about this one, right? I was 4 years old, she said, right? I was a quick starter. I was reading at 4. But I was obsessed with Ronald Reagan. He was the president of America at the time. And so when people used to ask me, what are you going to do when you grow up? I used to say, I'm going to be president of America. And they would say, but you'll have to leave Ireland for that. And I said, don't worry, I'll buy myself a Concorde. That was the plane at the time. Could be in New York in 2 hours and back, right? I said, sure, I'll fly in every morning and come home in the evening. This is a four-year-old now. This is the dream I had, right? As I became a teenager, I got very much into playing with computers. That's computers way before what we have now. Like, I mean, to render just a 3D image, which you could now type on Word, took 24 hours. And at that time, I was connecting that into video, doing silly things with that. And I used to love Steven Spielberg. Where I come from, I could never make the connection of how I could ever be Steven Spielberg. You know, now I was in Hollywood 2 years ago with some of my team, and I said, you know what, guys, when I was a teenager, I often thought I would love to be here. Now we're here, and we're here because we're a brand in the entertainment, sports and media, and we're here because we belong here. And it's funny, like, how all the roads, no matter what, eventually led to me being in an entertainment industry, an industry that as a kid, I would never thought that I could do. I was the shyest kid. I couldn't speak to anybody. In fact, I remember my father, I was 19 years old. I was in the accountancy job. He came home one day and I was in my parents' house, and he was talking to my mother about a strange guy. Right? And he said, oh, that guy's always strange. He doesn't look you in the eye when he's speaking to you. And I'm sitting beside the fire and I was like, I don't look people in the eye when I speak to them. My father must think I'm weird too. I never had the courage that I always looked at the floor. Like I was really shy, right? And if someone, I would have said at the time, the one thing I'll never be is a salesperson. How did that change?
Which is the thing that you are most proud of it?
That's a tough question. There's been so many things over the last years. And then the thing is too, that your horizon changes as you go. So the thing that I've been proud of 15 years ago, now I look back and go, that's such a small thing. I think one of the proudest things is that I have been able to develop a business that is both impactful and commercially sound. Because what most people would say is, if you are impactful or you're trying to do good, then you must be a foundation, you must be a charity. And then if you're commercially sound, then it's just commercial and that's all it is. So, and that has been a big challenge, right? Especially with investment or even commercial partners, they're looking at you and going, so your product is good? That's what your product is. Like, the product is finding the diamonds in young people and helping them diamonds to shine. And so most of these young people, and we need to talk about them now before this finish up, because we'll go there next, to be able to monetize a real impact. And so the impact is in two ways. Young people get a chance to show what their creativity is worth, and how that can be valued by other people. And then the planet, because we do so much sustainability education. So this is a circular mindset. So if you take the challenge, and I'm going to give it to you, and in 6 months you can send me pictures, right? And so audience is there bearing witness to the challenge, is that between the three, I won't ask you to do it individually, is to make something from trash that's here in your office. So collect the trash for 2 or 3 weeks, sit down and see how difficult it is. And I hope we can share some photos, because I will talk about some of them in a minute. It is very difficult, but it is also very rewarding. And it's an entrepreneurial journey, because you will fail. Things will not work out. You have to come back again. Then there's a marketing component in it, because you have to do that voting that we talked about earlier. And then what I call the 1 minute at the show is like an elevator pitch. You have to wow 5,000 people in a minute. That's not easy. And so if I am able to show a photo, if you can do that for me, but I'll tell you about this guy. His name is Maxim. I met the guy in 2018. He entered the competition his first season. He didn't do very well. He went away and he rethought the whole thing. And he said, okay, I'm going to build something that has the potential to win. That was what his goal was. So he knitted the suit that he wore with the old VHS cassette. You guys are probably too young to remember VHS, but VHS was the thing before CDs and DVDs. And then as part of that, we did the Royal Film Premiere with him, but now we have partnerships, so I don't have to fake that anymore. But he was there with Prince Charles. It was the movie 1917, it was a war movie. Sam Mendes was the director, the guy Richard Madden from Game of Thrones. All he wanted to do was meet Richard Madden. And so he got his dream. But so he went to the red carpet with that. And then we also did Cannes, who now we have a partnership with him too. And in Cannes, I don't know if you know this, but between Nice, Cannes and Nice and Monaco, there's a like a Uber helicopter service.
Okay.
Called Blade.
Interesting.
Makes sense.
Yeah. It's really good. So they have the same services in the US from JFK into Manhattan. Blade is the app. You can download the app Blade.
I'll download it.
Yeah. And it's worth to do, right? I mean, if you go to Monaco, it's 7 minutes. So when you come through the airport, you have a book, the guy's waiting for you. He takes you with your luggage to the helicopter. You take off just at the same where the planes are. You land in Monaco and then a black Mercedes takes you to your hotel, right? It's a nice experience. So at the lowest price is 100 euros. So I mean, the taxi is 105. Okay, you can put three people in one taxi for 100, but if you want to go, it's a good experience. So I put the kids in the helicopter for 100 euros each. They didn't know it was 100 euro. But I told them, right, we're going now to Monaco from Cannes. Helicopters arrived. The kids are going, what? Kids in the helicopter, flew them into Monaco. We did a small party on the beach. These kids are going, what? How do I get here? But the thing I want to say was the guy was interviewed by somebody on radio like a year later. And he was telling the story like I was in the Cannes Film Festival. I went in helicopter to Monaco. I was at the Royal Film Premiere. And the person doing the interview was like, adults don't get to do these things. You're 17 years old. These things are huge. Then she said, the question was, what was the biggest thing? Which was the biggest one? And so he pauses for a second. And the 17-year-old kid said, actually, none of them. The biggest thing for me was I found my personality. And at that moment, and I was listening, and I was like, for most people, they won't understand that. But that was powerful for me to hear that. And it wasn't that he found his personality. It was because it was always there. It was that other people saw it. And this is the same thing I talked to you around about the validate, third-party validation. So much stronger than self. So because before you'll just doubt everything. And that was then the realization for me, the power of being seen for who you are is so powerful. And there are so many people in the world who are walking around living a complete life that they didn't want because either a teacher, a parent, a friend said one line to them when they were a kid. I remember the two celebrities that I want to talk about is Robbie Williams, global superstar, 100 million sales, all kinds of albums. And he decides to write a poem and put a video of it online on YouTube because he wants to address a teacher that when he was 15, told him he would never make anything being a performer. And I was like, but he's achieved so much. How can this teacher still be here in his shoulder saying to him, you're not good enough, that he's 40. He had to make this video. And this is the power of words to young people. And I'm not going to ask you to reveal it, right? But the four of us sitting here tonight, every one of you, including me, have been said things to that are still in here holding us back.
You can use it as a fuel though.
You can use it as a fuel.
It like right? A superpower.
But it amplifies the minute you say it out. That was the point I had. When the minute he said that out, right? It's the same as the moment I said every one of those kids was me. I was hiding it. Sure, that was the fuel. That was the thing that was going to push me through the wall. But the minute I said it, then I became the real me. And then people started to listen. Before that, I was fake. I was trying to tell a story that I thought people wanted to hear about me. I put walls to cover the things that would hide that. So that kid, Maxim, now I see him, he's growing into a guy that's 21, 22 years old. He's doing a master's at St. Martin's in London about circular textiles and how he can scale some of these ideas. But he will talk about, he's coming to Monaco to the World Final, about how Junketure changed that in him. Just gave him the validation that what he did was, what his skills were incredible.
Do you personally have like an end goal? Because like you've done so many things that you could just retire. So is there a point you reach when you say that, you know, I'm done?
I do. Right. And then I worry sometimes, you know, the horizon changes. But after I did the MIT master's, I finished up there in June. The goal I have is two. So at the top of the board, we have the two goals. Can we impact the lives of 1 billion young people? And can we drive $1 billion revenue every year? And so every decision we make every day, I've talked about this before, but the way I describe it as a game of golf, right? And I know now we know you don't play golf, right? But if you think a game of golf, if I sent you out tomorrow to play golf and took away the flags, how difficult would it be? Like it would be exponentially much more difficult. And even though with the flags in, you can still hit the sand trap or you can go in the water, but everybody's aiming for that flag. with nothing to aim at, you will go all over the place. You will waste time. So eventually you will get there, but you will waste time. And I think the thing for me is the 18th flag, as I call it, the one at the end, is that flag that says 1 billion kids, 1 billion revenue. And then I have all the flags. So I have 10 years of flags, right back to where I am now. The whole team knows the flags. We go out to shoot together every day. If we get the holes, we get the holes. If we don't, we come back, analyze, how do we go? We're still shooting for this flag. One of the things that I want to say about a company like Junkature is that it is so rewarding. So yes, money is rewarding, but working with your purpose, your why, it's so, so powerful as for you as a person. It empowers you.
So what is your relationship with Mr. Spanidis? Because you told us before that this is the reason that you are here in Greece.
And we thank him a lot for that.
Yes.
So Tassos, I met at a retreat 16 months ago. Immediately, I was drawn to the guy. I describe him as a nuclear reactor. And even like what I say to him, like even when I'm in his company for 2 hours and I leave, I need 2 hours just for the radiation to come out of me, right? Because he has this effect on you, right? And like the last two nights I've been here, I've been in Greece now for 2 days. We finish up at 11 o'clock. I can't sleep because I like the radiation, it's still there, right? But I met him 16 months ago. We immediately were drawn to each other. He likes big ideas, big plans. So he said to me, I can see so many things with this. And so we start talking. And then 8 months ago, he joined my board. And I showed him a map of the plan that I had to expand across the world. So my business model is very much like Formula One. I went to a lot of Formula One races. So it was a tour around the world from January to August every year with these different cities every 2 weeks. And his question was, where's Greece? Why is Greece not in this? I don't know if the Greek government are paying him to say them things, but he was like this huge advocate. He was like, man, don't you realize what Greece is doing? The entrepreneurship here, we are forging a new future. This is the business of the future, circularity, education, sustainability, entrepreneurship. This needs to be in Greece. You have to come. So he started then saying to me, I will set up meetings, I will do this. And so the caliber of people that he was putting together, I said, okay, I will come for 3 days. Let's make it happen. So I arrived on Wednesday. I go home tomorrow to sleep. That's what I do. But he's a fantastic man. He's built an incredible business himself. He's a global player and he has a global mindset and he likes challenges. So it's not just the $1 billion, it's the 1 billion kids, because the way we look at it is that there's a kid in every classroom in the world. And so this belongs in every classroom in the world. That's the point when we'll have reached 1 billion people and it'll be time to go. Let's hand it to somebody else to take it to wherever they think is the next place to go.
How do you build this global mindset? Because you have global mindset, you are a global player too, but it's something difficult, I think, because all of us, we have to play first in local.
Harry, you're right, because that is difficult, right? Because, I mean, you take where I come from, a really rural place in Ireland. So the same, I remember a conversation we had when we got our first big sponsor, a New York-based one. And so we had to submit price per day for the team to do things if they wanted, the sponsor wanted them to work for them. So I remember them putting a quote together, 200 euros per day per person, right? And I was like, guys, we're thinking of this with the Donegal mindset. What are you talking about? You're sending this quote to a global company that's based in Rockefeller Center in New York, where 200 euros doesn't even pay the coffee for the day. They're going to think, is this guy coming to clean the floors? Like 200 euros doesn't register with them. They charge 10,000 per hour. So we're going to make ourselves look insignificant. And so that's the challenge, is how do you raise not just them out of that, but yourself? And I remember last year, and I think travel is a big part to play in that. The more travel you can do, if you can move to another place. But again, a lot to do with the people you surround yourself with, because you will listen to them and you will soak it up. It's like me, I'm saying it's radiation. But you know Tassos now, right? The guy is a nuclear reactor. Like, he comes in here.
Bomb.
Yeah, that's it, right? And so you want to soak it up. You need it. And the ideas and the way he speaks, the way he addresses people, the way he goes after something when he's aggressive. But when I lived in Ireland and then I did a lot of travel, I in 30 countries. It's not many, but I spent a lot of time in the US. I've been 50 times. And it's like that. I've pushed through doors. And then when I've been there, I listened. But the year before last year, I moved to Madrid. Then I moved to Abu Dhabi. And when I was finished in Abu Dhabi, I was making a list of where I wanted to move to. There was a guy I met through MIT called Warren Rustand. He had a big impression on me too. He wrote a book, Life by Design. And I read this book. I remember sitting down with my wife and I says, okay, we're going to design our life. We're finished in Abu Dhabi. Let's design what the perfect life for us looks like. So one of the first things I went was, I need to be in a place that has international connections, has capital, has people with global mindset. I couldn't go back to Ireland because that didn't qualify. And then I put other things like I wanted to live careless, right? So I wanted to have no car in my life. I wanted to live obligation free. So a car brings bills for fuel and tires and taxes and whatever. So I start to look at my life and say, okay, what obligations do I have on a monthly basis? They will somehow affect decisions at some point because I have to do something with it. So I was like, I want to be obligation free. That was one of the things I wanted to do. Take away anything that causes any kind of a bill. And I cut the monthly bills away down. And also I wanted to, when we lived in Madrid, we had no car. So we walked 1 kilometer to the supermarket. But when we lived in Ireland, the supermarket was 300 meters and we drove because it's culture. So I was like, I want to get away from that. I want to walk more, whatever. But I put all these things down. And I had New York, London, and the one that circled them all was Monaco. And I think the two biggest reasons was, one, access to capital. Because if you want to scale a business to $1 billion, you're going to need capital. And number two was this core group of people that have been there, done it, huge companies, understand what it takes, the challenges, and understand too that it is possible. And one thing that Monaco has, there's 34,000 population. 22,000 of those are expats. So they're the entrepreneurial people, the former CEOs, all in a square mile. It's concentrated. You meet them in the street. You meet them in the bar. They will sit down and talk. I sent them emails. I guessed the email address of Stelios from EasyJet. I said, come to my event. He said, I'm in St. Bart's, but I'll have a coffee with you when I come back. If I sent that email from Ireland, I wouldn't have a coffee with him when I come back.
No.
So that's the way it is. So it's the same. So my advice to like you guys as young entrepreneurs or anybody listening is seek out people like Tassos. Join organizations like entrepreneurs organizations, young presidents organizations, Endeavor, those ones that will put you in rooms with people who are two or three above you. Because if nothing else, you'll want to be like them. So you will change your goals. You will be in rooms where bigger deals are done, because that's a thing that, you know, you can grow your business by increasing your customers or increasing the size of money that you get, the deal that you do. And so at MIT, for example, I remember this guy, he does natural disaster recoveries. So when there's an earthquake, the government sends him in to work out how much is going to be or whatever, right? Insurance stuff. He told me last year, the first year what he got out of MIT, I got the why. The thing he got was bigger deal sizes grows business faster. And so the thing that he left there with was he changed the rules in the company to say, we will not do any deals less than $50 million. I was going, okay, any deals less than $50 million. He said, the first two or three that came in were like small ones, 5 million, 7 million. And he had to say no. And he was like, is this a bad idea? He said, but in the 3 years since that, we're now doing deals at 150, 200 million. All because we have the time. We were wasting so much time doing these little tiny deals. The insurance of, I don't know, a bridge that fell down or needed repaired. He said, so we stopped doing that. We don't care who does that anymore. We only do the big ones. But he says that freed up so much of our time that we didn't see wasting our time with all these little things. So now he says the last deal I did was 170 million. I'd have never done that deal if I was still doing the little ones. So everybody's got a different pathway. But if you can get yourself into an education program like that, I think one of the things, the entrepreneurs organization is one of their things, thirst for learning. You have to be addicted to bettering yourself. The person that drives it the most is you. You will find others that fill the bits, but you have to constantly be What can I learn? Like, Tassos today had me on a training. He said to me, there's a guy here I want you to meet. I think your negotiation skills could be a little bit better. Let's spend the day with him. I will spend it too. Let's look at the way Junkature is doing this, doing that. We spent an incredible day. And I have to say, the guy videoed me doing different things. When I watched it back, I was like, this is game changing for me. Little things that I didn't realize. The way I said something in a sales conversation versus the way I should. How it unlocked more money than just, it's the same thing, but just say it a different way. So thirst for learning. Do you read? You guys read?
Yeah,
reading. I've read, I think the best book I've ever read was Shoe Dog.
Oh, yeah.
One of the first books that I read.
Yeah.
Well, and the thing that resonated with me in that book was that, Phil Knight, it takes a long time to get it right. It takes a long time.
Promotion of the book.
Yeah.
It's in Greek, but.
Yeah. He was at it for like 13, 14 years, and no profit, no cash. And I remember when I was reading the book, one night I was in the couch and I started to laugh, and my wife said, "You're really enjoying that book. What are you laughing at?" And I says, "Oh, I'm laughing at this conversation that he just had with his wife, because we also had the same conversation, but you're doing better than his wife." And she said, "What are you talking about?" And I said, "Well, he's after saying to his wife that if this doesn't work on Monday, we're homeless." And she said, "Right?" And I said, "Whenever I had that conversation with you, I said, if this doesn't work, we're going to be in a caravan. So you're ahead by a caravan. His wife was going to be homeless. You were getting a caravan. So at least be happy, right?" Because that's that entrepreneurial journey that people don't see. And like, people will see Nike now and say, "Oh, that's a huge brand. Of course it was going to be. But it was just the honesty of, and the cheating. He was cheating. He was cheating the invoice discounter. He was putting in invoices for shoes and buying a factory with the money. And then when he got found out, that was the conversation I had with the wife, going, "This guy comes back on Monday and sees I bought a factory with his money. Like, I'm out of business." Instead, they got over that hurdle. And that's the thing. It's the ability to get over those hurdles and keep going. But read, expose yourself to other ideas and other people.
I think you already answered the question that we always made in the end of this conversation. This question is, if you had to give an advice to your younger self or to a young entrepreneur, which was this advice?
I have never answered this question, but I've thought about it many times because I listen to other podcasts and it's a question that people get asked. I said, so now I get the chance to answer it myself. Two things. One, you don't have to do it for anybody else. And I think one of the things that I was so worried about was the impression I made for other people. It was almost like, I had the big car, the big house. Didn't need any of those things. Who was I trying to impress? I didn't need to impress anybody. If I went back to the start, I was like, if I'd learned earlier, you don't need to impress anybody else. As long as you're happy and you're doing what your purpose is, things are great. And the other one, which I think is much stronger, is your best friend is yourself. Do not have bad conversations with your best friend. And what I mean by that was, I was my worst critic. So when I screwed up, I used to say, "Of course you screwed up. You're an idiot. You're an idiot. You're an idiot." If your best friend said to you over and over, "You're an idiot. You're an idiot," you'd punch their lights out. I had to change that chip in my head and say, "Okay, this one didn't work. You know, the next time you will do it. You can do it. You can do it." That has had a huge fundamental change in me as a person. I realize, and I come across people all the time, and then they'll say randomly, "You're out for a drink," and they'll say, "Oh, I did this last week, and sure, I'm an idiot." I was like, "Whoa, do you realize what you just said to yourself? You're not saying it to me. Your brain has sucked that in. You are your best friend, and you're telling yourself you're an idiot. What do you think you're going to believe? You're going to continue to believe you're an idiot. You need to change that around, and that takes work. But now it's like that. I would have not liked it on photos. I think I don't look good to it. Now I'm like, sure, give me the camera. I'm as good as anybody else. I can do it. If I had known that earlier, I think I would have been farther along in the journey. But you can never change the journey. You are who you are. As long as I've learned it at this point, I'm happy about it.
Perfect ending of our conversation.
Thanks, guys. It's been great to be here now.
I want to thank you so much for your time. Thank you for being here. have the honor to be the first international guest that we have.
Yes, it's hard to believe. Like, I mean, there's nobody before. So first international guest, an Irishman. Yeah. But Irishmen have done first so many things in the world. So I'll just add that to the list of all the other famous Irish people who have done incredible things.
And I hope that's also for you, like a small thing to have and rewatch after years and see where you're at and have it like a small reminder.
Thank you very much. So this was an episode for today. I hope you liked this episode, and don't forget to make like and subscribe the channel. So till the next episode, I hope to be well and follow your dreams.